Hello, this is Beverly Tomasi, and I'd like to welcome all of you to our webcast today. I'm very, very excited to be presenting this to you, a patient-centered medication update with a special focus on inhaled insulin. And if you're just joining us, you can download the handout on our website, diabetesed.net, under Resources, Live Diabetes Webcast Meds Update. And if you can download our pocket cards, too, that will be a big help because we'll be referring to those frequently during this webcast. I'm Beverly Tomasian, as I've mentioned, and it's a real honor for me to be talking about inhaled insulin. I have some familiarity with inhaled insulin because I was intimately involved with a Pfizer inhaled insulin called Exubera, and that didn't quite make it, and so now we're seeing a different version, an updated version of this inhaled insulin that, with fingers crossed, will be a real success, because I feel like inhaled insulin offers patients another option besides taking injections, and a lot of our patients have injection fatigue, and also needles can be really scary for people. So this is an exciting time. We've been, you know, they've been working on different ways of delivering insulin since it was invented and discovered. And so now in 2014, we have another option to offer our patients, and hopefully in the future, we'll have a lot more options. Here's some web clinic details. You can listen via your phone or through your computer. If you have questions, we'll try and answer questions during the program, but I always stay 15 minutes after and answer any questions that you might have. You can also email me after the presentation, and I will be happy to answer any questions. There's no CEs. If you signed up for the free webinar, there's no CEs. It's just free information I want to share with you. I want to get the word out. I want to provide you with as many resources as I can. But if you'd like to earn 1.5 CEs, you just have to sign up to our online university, and you can earn 1.5 units for this program. Now, as mentioning earlier, this is actually the fifth in a series of broadcasts I've been doing called the Diabetes Mini-Series, and we've been covering a lot of exciting topics. And today was just perfect timing that inhaled insulin was released, that we can include the inhaled insulin as part of our medication update program. So it was serendipitous and a wonderful event that on our fifth session, we get to talk about this. So if you're interested, all of these sessions are recorded. You can still purchase them, earn 7.5 CEs. It's $89, and listen to all of them in a recorded version. It's so easy on the online university. And then you take the exam and the survey, and you print out your certificate at that moment. So it's just a real convenient way to earn CEs and get really good information about diabetes that can help you if you're taking the CDE exam or just for a general update and review. So that's our Diabetes Education University. So what we're going to talk about today is, here it is, the inhaled insulin. But we're going to put that within a framework. So we're not just going to talk about inhaled insulin as an isolated event. We're going to put it into terms of how does this fit into our treatment plan and our medication therapies that we currently have available for diabetes. So we're going to look at the ADA and the AACE approaches to managing hyperglycemia. Now, I'm sure you know the ADA is American Diabetes Association. The AACE is American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. So they're a different group of professionals. And I would say the difference between ADA and AACE is ADA has a little bit more of a public health bent, and that they make recommendations that people throughout the globe can achieve with limited resources, with limited funds, limited access to tests, and some barriers. The AACE goals, as you'll see, are a little bit more stringent, and I think their notion is, let's just go toward the best possible therapy and intervention. So many times, how do I use these guidelines? I'll start off with the ADA guidelines, and if my patients can achieve those, I move on to the AACE guidelines, and you'll see what I mean. So I find it a stepwise approach to diabetes management. We'll look at strategies to treat hyperglycemia from lifestyle to medication, and lifestyle is an intervention. It's a therapeutic intervention. We'll look at insulin therapy and inhaled insulin, and that's the first half. And then the second half, we're going to talk about oral medications and injectables for type 2. So we're going to kind of first focus on inhaled and then move on, inhaled and insulin, and move on to oral medications for type 2 and injectables. So this is an hour and a half webcast. Originally, it was going to be an hour, but I realized there's so much content I want to share with you. I just expanded it to an hour and a half. So I know many of you are busy. You have a lot on your plate. So if you can't complete the entire session today, be reassured it is recorded and you can just go to the place you want to start at. So you can just start halfway through and hear the rest of it. Diabetes in America. These are the new CDC stats, just came out in 2014. Things are not getting better. We are having more and more diabetes. 29 million Americans, or 9.3%. That's up. So about 1 in 10 Americans have diabetes. A quarter of those don't know they have it. And this number is killing me. 37% of adults have prediabetes. So they're marching toward diabetes, 37%. We know that maybe 20% of those will go over to diabetes in the next 3 to 5 years. We have an epidemic on our hands. And yes, we want to prevent diabetes. And yes, we need to treat those who have it effectively to help prevent complications. So let's talk about treatment. How do we manage hyperglycemia with patients with type 2 diabetes? And this was released, this position statement, in 2012 in Diabetes Care and Diabetology. And this from the American Diabetes Association and the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. And what they said is they came together, these countries came together and said, what can be a standard approach to help get blood glucose levels to goal? So whenever you see this ADAESD on a slide, that means this is their content. I'm just copying it. They gave permission to speakers to copy the content to get the word out. So I've maintained the content the same as their original slides. So this is exactly from what they've said. And I just kind of glammed it up a little bit with my colors. So type 2, what is broken? What is the pathogenesis of type 2 diabetes? So many times when I talk to my patients, I don't use the word pathogenesis. I'm like, what's broken with type 2 diabetes? These are the things that are broken. We know that the pancreas isn't working right. There's insulin secretory dysfunction. There's not enough insulin secretory dysfunction, enough insulin being produced. So that means not enough insulin in the bloodstream and the pancreas isn't able to rise to that challenge. In addition, there's resistance in the muscle, fat, and liver to the insulin that is produced. And then there's increased endogenous glucose production. What does that mean? That means the liver is pumping out sugar. The liver that stores glycogen is not kept in check by insulin, so there's this hepatic glycogen release. Glycogenolysis, where the liver is just breaking down glycogen stores, cranking up blood sugars between meals, after meals, because not enough insulin is available to keep the liver in check. There's problems with the fat cells. There's not enough incretins being made. So the incretins are the satiation hormones, the GLP and the GIP, are not being released in adequate amounts, so we don't get a feeling of satiation. And then the kidneys, on top of it, are reabsorbing glucose. And so the kidneys, instead of having a renal threshold of 180, which is normal, that renal threshold is bumped up to 210. So the kidneys keep reabsorbing glucose and adding to this hyperglycemic situation. So this is just a picture saying the same thing. Really, we don't have enough of the gut hormones being released to tell the pancreas to make insulin. The pancreas is not making enough insulin, but it's making extra glucagon, and that glucagon tells the liver to crank out glucose. Our fat cells are insulin resistant, and there's more triglycerides. Our muscle cells are insulin resistant, and they just don't take up enough glucose. And our brain isn't getting a message that we're full, so it keeps sending out signals to eat more. This is the problem with, these are the defects in type 2 diabetes. And this is in part why exercise is so important, because it's going to help increase insulin sensitivity at the muscle. And losing weight is very important because it helps the beta cells work better. And so we're trying to figure out ways to decrease this hyperglycemia. We know lifestyle makes a big difference, but for some of our patients, lifestyle might not be enough. We might have to add a pharmaceutical intervention. This is from the American Diabetes Association. What are glycemic targets? The ADA says less than 7% is what we're working on for A1C. That means preprandial blood sugars, less than 130, and postprandial, less than 180. That's the target. Now listen to this. So they say, let's individualize it based on what the patient brings to the table. Tighter targets for younger, healthier people. So 6 to 6.5. So patients who don't have a lot of hypoglycemia, who have a long life expectancy, who can really do intensive insulin management, let's consider getting those targets tighter. But for our older patients with comorbidities, our frail elderly, they're at risk for hypoglycemia, we can actually relax those targets and let them go all the way up to 8%. The main goal here is we want to avoid hypoglycemia. So what I'd like to do right now, before we keep moving on, is launch a poll. So I just wanted to know, do you discuss medication starts with your patients? All right. Thank you for answering. I really appreciate it. Many of us as educators, we may not have prescriptive authority, but certainly we may help, you know, patients with adjustment or suggesting to providers the best therapy that's available. I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share it with you. So many of you said, yeah, about half of you said frequently I suggest medication changes or adjustments. 30% of you sometimes, and the rest of you don't do it very often. And I would just encourage you, as you become more and more familiar with these medications and how they work and the targets for patients, that we can be tremendous advocates for our people with diabetes. If they're not getting glucose to goal, you know, at the very least, we can talk to the patient and say, you really need to talk to your doctor about changing this therapeutic intervention to help you reach these targets. And many times as a diabetes consultant, I'm faxing doctors, I'm calling providers, and I'm making suggestions and medications. So we all have a different comfort level in that area, but as educators in whatever capacity you are, we really want to help our patients get the best glucose control possible, because studies show that the earlier we achieve glucose control, the better the long-term outcomes are. That's from the legacy trials. So as early as we can, we want to really help our patients get those glucose to targets, to target ranges. The American Diabetes Association, in their last statement, also had really a revolutionary notion here. And they said, we should really use a patient-centered approach, that instead of telling patients what to do, the compliance model, that really didn't seem to work that well. So let's actually engage the patient and provide care that is respectful and responsive to their preferences, needs, and values, ensuring that the patient's values guide all clinical decisions. This is revolutionary. This is so exciting. When I read this, I was just thrilled to death, because I've seen so many patients who've been given prescriptions who never fill them, and I know you have too, because they weren't engaged in the decision-making process. So what we want to do is make sure our patients are in touch and are consulted and know the pros and cons of the medications in the way that they can understand it. So this is really, really exciting. I just wanted to ask you one other question. What do you think, based on that, is the ADA's philosophy on encouraging patients, you know, on hyperglycemic management for diabetes? And you can choose more than one on this. More than one is okay. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for voting. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to close this and share this with you. And I think the main message we want to get across, and the ADA wants to get across, is to engage patients in decision-making process, in that sometimes we may have to let that A1C go up a little bit higher, up to 8% for those frail elderly patients. That is true, too. I'm going backward up the list. And maintain an A1C of less than 6.5% only if the patient can actually do it. And then this interesting thing I said, B, start all patients on metformin. Actually, we start most patients on metformin, but as we go through, we're going to see there might be some exceptions to that. And as far as encouraging compliance, the ADA has really stepped away from that compliance model and said, let's get the patient engaged. And you know what? If the patient isn't able to participate in their care and not take their medications as we have suggested, we need to look for other barriers that are happening. So it's not really about compliance, it's about engaging the participant, the patient, in the process. And this is an excellent slide about looking at how do we approach management of hyperglycemia. Are we going to be more stringent or less stringent? And if we look at patient attitudes and expected treatment efforts, if that patient is really highly motivated and adherent and can do it all, we're going to be stringent. We're going to add on multiple medications, maybe do basal bolus. We're going to really, you know, use all the different tools we have. But we're going to be a little bit less stringent if the patient isn't that motivated, doesn't really have very good social support or self-care skills. You know, we suggest things and we work on different goals. We're not able to do it. We have to modify what we're going to do with them to match what they can actually do. So I really don't believe in noncompliance. I believe that sometimes we give patients more than they're capable of doing. So we need to really look at their situation they bring and match the treatment plan to what they're able to do. And the other thing here is resources, support systems. If they already have vascular complications, if they don't have very many vascular complications, we can be pretty stringent. But if they've had a heart attack and a stroke and other vascular disease, we're not going to be as, we're not going to add on as many meds because they may be more risk for hypoglycemia and complications. So we really look at the individual patient when we're figuring out the treatment plan. So that's ADA. What does AACE say about this? What is the goal for AACE? They have a little bit different strategy. They say for most patients that are healthy and without any concurrent illness and low risk for hypo, let's get the A1C to less than 6.5%. And then they say, well, if the patient has concurrent illness or at risk for hypoglycemia, A1C more than 6.5 is a target. So you can see these organizations kind of see the world a little bit differently. And so I just want to point that out. And if you're taking the CDE exam, this question has appeared on the CDE exam recently. The American Association for Clinical Endocrinology also has a prediabetes algorithm, which I think is really worth taking a look at. And that is prediabetes is impaired fasting glucose 100 to 125 or impaired glucose tolerance of 140 to 199. That's how they define it, and that's how it's universally defined. But look what they say. First of all, start lifestyle modification. And so what we're going to do, it might, you know, help that patient with exercise, getting active, losing weight, all of that, including gastric bypass is an option. So you're seeing that more and more in position statements that for patients with prediabetes, at high risk for diabetes, maybe we can look at gastric bypass, of course, getting them to a dietitian, maybe using meal replacement, something medically assisted to help them get that weight down. But the thing I do want to say about prediabetes is prediabetes is an indicator for future heart disease. And so if our patients have these elevated levels of glucose, we know they're at much higher risk of stroke and heart attack even before they're diagnosed with diabetes. So what they're saying is let's mitigate cardiovascular risk factors. Let's get their lipids down and lower their blood pressure and really work on anti-obesity therapies. These two together are critical. There's some good research now that's showing just a 2 to 8 kilogram body weight loss early on can really help protect beta cells. So losing that weight early in the process of diabetes is so, so important. Yet weight loss is one of the hardest things to do. But if that patient then progresses to overt diabetes, we're going to need to go to the hyperglycemia algorithm, which I'll get to in a minute. Interestingly enough, though, we might consider medications for these patients. If they have one prediabetes criterion, maybe they're just overweight, well, we're just going to intensify anti-obesity efforts. But if they have multiple prediabetes criteria, and for example, they're overweight, you know, they're diabetes runs in their family, they had gestational diabetes, maybe we need to be a little bit more aggressive. So AACE says we could consider in either of these situations starting them on low-risk medications like metformin or acarbose. These are a little more tricky medications that we would reserve to if the patient doesn't respond to these. But here's the deal. I want to be honest with you. This is off-label. This is not part of the FDA approval where they initially approved these medications. They weren't approved for prediabetes. So this is based on clinical judgment. I just want to let you know, though, the AACE and the ADA are saying maybe for those high-risk patients, we should start them on metformin therapy, even when they have prediabetes, to maybe stop the progression to diabetes. So this is the ADA again. What is the first step if a patient has high blood sugar? The first step is lifestyle changes, the first step. It used to say start metformin. They changed it. Lifestyle changes, weight control, healthy eating, activity is what this patient is going to need to get going on. So we're going to have to call out our resource people, get them into a diabetes program, get the dietitian to see them, engage them with physical therapy if that will be helpful, a lifestyle coach, you know, get them involved in these different groups, support groups to help them succeed at lifestyle changes. Lifestyle changes are hard to do and to keep going. The other thing I want to say is that at diagnosis, this is from the ADA, a highly motivated patient with an A1C of near target could try lifestyle changes 3 to 6 months before starting metformin therapy. Interesting. So I just want to put that out there that some of our patients may say, you know what, I don't want to start meds. I'm motivated. I want to lose weight. I want to exercise. Can I try it for 3 months without medications? Yes, they can. But we want to make sure we don't lose them, because sometimes if patients aren't started on medications, and this is, I'm not promoting medications for this reason, but they may not take it as seriously, and some studies have shown that they're more easily lost. So we need to make sure to put a tickler file and contact them again to see how things are going. This is the American Diabetes Association algorithm for diabetes management. So you can see they start with metformin therapy. That's the first one. If we don't reach our A1C target within 3 to 6 months, we're going to start metformin, or we start it right away if the patient's high risk. And then we're going to add a secondary medication. So we're going to metformin plus another medication. And if we still are not at target, we're going to add another medication, 3 medications. So usually they say after 2 to 3 medications, instead of adding a fourth, let's go to insulin, because it just gets very complicated. Patients have a hard time keeping track of all these medications. They interact with other medications, and they can it's just a very big burden for our clients. So before I go on to this next slide, I'd like to ask you a question. We're going to talk about the ACE guidelines next. But according to the ACE guidelines, if a patient comes in with an A1C of 7.8%, what would be our next action as far as a pharmaceutical intervention? All right. 7.8%. So you don't know the answer yet because I haven't told you, so just take a guess. All right. Most of you have voted. So I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. So most of you said start metformin. About 9% of you said, well, let's start some basal insulin. 20% of you said start 2 medications. And actually, you are correct. That's what AACE says. So they have a different approach to medication therapy. They don't say start metformin and then add another medication if A1C isn't to goal. They say, A, let's start with lifestyle modification, just like ADA. So let's, you know, think about how we can help these people lose weight, get active. But if their A1C is less than 7.5, let's start monotherapy. If their A1C is more than 7.5 but less than 9, let's start dual therapy, two medications. And their number one medication, just like ADA, is metformin. So we would say metformin plus another agent. And these agents are ranked in priority as safest and best, according to the AACE studies and research they've done. So you can see the next best here is a GLP-1, which is a glucagon-like peptide agonist like Byetta, Bydureon, Victoza, or the DPP-4, like the Januvia, Zonglyza. So they say if they're higher than 7.5, start 2. And then if they're somewhere in this category, we might start 3. If this doesn't work, we got to add 3, or we're going to have to go on to insulin therapy. So let's talk about insulin therapy and what that looks like. So we have different kinds of insulin to utilize here, and the oldest that's been around forever since 1920s is human regular. And human regular is now available injected or inhaled, very exciting. We have MPH, our basal insulin, that lasts for about a half a day, and we have the rapid acting analogs that get in, do their job quick, and get out after about 4 hours. And then we have basal. These are insulins that last for 12 to 24 hours, and they're very similar in mimicking our own basal insulin, and we have premixed varieties. And so here's our insulin pocket card, and I just want to point out a few things. In this pocket card, which you can download for free, we divided the insulins into different categories. Bolus insulin, which is getting in quick and doing its job and getting out. Bolus insulin is really used to lower after-meal glucose, and it goes along with food and hyperglycemia. The basal insulin, the MPH, Detemir, and Glargine, takes time to get working, and it lasts for about a half a day to a day. And then we have our basal and bolus premixed insulins. So before I go on to the next slide, I want to ask you one more question. And this is it. So which is of the following is true about inhaled insulin? Just take your best guess. Since we're going to be talking about it in a minute, I just want to pique your curiosity and see what of the following is true. And you can pick more than one answer. There's no wrong answers because we're just kind of getting ready for the slides to follow. All right, take one more second to vote. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. Thank you so much, everyone, for participating. I'll share this with you. So 30% of you said it's a powdered form of regular inhaled insulin, which is actually the right answer. And then 8% it's only approved for type 1s. It's actually approved for type 1s and type 2s. And 33% of you said it's approved for adults over 18. You are right. So let's hide this, and then we'll start talking about the inhaled insulin. Thank you. And so here again is just a summary of the bolus insulins we have available. And let's look at this case study, because I think this case study is going to help us as we launch into utilizing insulin therapy. We have a 70-year-old. He weighs 100 kilograms. He has a history of CABG, and he's a smoker or ex-smoker. He hasn't smoked for a year. His A1C is 11.3, and his blood glucose has been about 400 to 500 for the past few weeks. So he's running really high. The provider put him on 100 units of Lantus at bedtime, Solostar, and his blood sugars are just not coming down. He's coming in to see us, and he's just so discouraged and distraught. His oral medications are metformin and Invokana, which we'll talk about later. But the first thing I want to ask you is, what is a better insulin dosing strategy? And this is actually from the AACE. What are some insulin dosing strategies that we can use to help get our patients to target? And again, it looks at starting basal insulin. So this is very common, where we say, let's start basal first, and if basal doesn't work, let's add bolus. And what they say is that the A1C is less than 8%, we can start at a lower basal rate, 0.1 to 2 units of insulin per kilogram. But if the A1C is greater than 8, let's start the basal rate at a little bit higher range. And then what we're going to do is increase it. So you look at the fasting blood sugar and you increase basal based on fasting blood sugar. And if that morning blood sugar is more than 180, we're going to increase the nighttime or daytime basal by 4 units and so forth. And very important, if there's low blood sugar happening, we have to decrease the basal. But in this particular patient, his A1C was so high, we just went ahead and switched him over because I want to tell you something really important. When basal is more than about 0.3 units of insulin per kilogram, so let me just do some math with you. So that guy weighs 100 kilograms, and he's on 100 units of Lantus. So I would look at this formula and say, generally, the high range of basal is about 0.3 units of insulin per kilogram, so he should be on about 30 units of basal. Once he goes over 30 units of basal and his blood sugars are still not controlled, I know he needs some bolus insulin. And so I just want to point out, we see this a lot in our patients. They're called, it's over-basalization. They're getting way more basal insulin than they need, and their blood sugars are not at target. So I always do a quick calculation, and I see, using this formula based on their body weight in kilograms, are they on more than 0.3 units of insulin per kilogram of body weight? And if they are, I know they need some bolus insulin. So here's a formula to use if we want to convert them over to basal bolus. And we say the total daily dose is about 0.5 units of insulin per kilogram. So that would be 100 kilograms times 5. They need 50 units a day of insulin based on their body weight. Half of that should be basal, half of that should be prandial. So that would mean about 25 units of basal insulin and 25 units of mealtime insulin. So 25 of basal, 25 of mealtime prandial insulin. So let's just say if you take 25 units of mealtime insulin, you don't take it that all in one dose. You have to divide it into three meals, which would equal 8 units approximately per meal. So what if we wanted to actually put this patient on inhaled insulin? Would it work for this patient? Well, it just might. So let's keep this patient in mind as we go through and figure out if Afrezza might be an option for him. So Afrezza inhaled insulin finally approved by the FDA after many years of struggling and trying to get it approved. It was approved for type 1s or type 2s. It was only studied in adults over the age of 18, but as part of the agreement of approving this medication, Afrezza had to agree that they would do post-marketing studies on kids. So that's going to happen. We're going to see if it works okay in youth. And in the animal models, it did pass the breast milk and the placenta, so it's not indicated for pregnancy or while breastfeeding. And here is a great slide comparing subcutaneous insulin lispro with inhaled insulin. So the Afrezza is a solid line and the lispro is here in the dotted line. And what you can see is they actually have a very similar peak of action. They start working in about 15 minutes, really getting to the, you know, the main the steady state in the bloodstream, getting those blood insulin levels up. It takes about 15 minutes. But you can see the Afrezza has a little bit of a shorter half-life. So within 3 hours, the Afrezza really is done, while the Lispro might be hanging out a little bit longer. And then, of course, if you had regular insulin has a much longer tail. But the thing in the studies that I was reading about, and, of course, now that we have it approved, we can do a lot more studies and get a lot more data, is that for some of the type 1s who were trying this inhaled insulin, they actually had to take a second puff or a second inhalation of insulin. So what they would do in the study is they took the insulin at the start of meal, would check their 2-hour postprandial, and if it was above target of 180, they would take an additional inhalation. So about 20 to 30% of the participants with type 1 had to take a second dose of inhaled insulin. And so for some of them, it didn't work, and for some of them, it really did work. The type 2s seemed to have a better response. So the type 2s, it was a very similar outcome data looking at improving glucose levels. And so I would just say, just like any medication, we're going to match this to the individual. So some type 1s, it may work great. Others, it may not do the job. So we're going to just have to evaluate that over time. But the one great thing about this medication is that they had lower incidence of hypoglycemia and less weight gain. So you can see why there's lower incidence of hypo, because it gets in fast and does its job and gets out. Here's some great news. The inhaled insulin is now in our pocket cards. We just updated our pocket cards, got them done on Friday, and so now they're available for download, and it includes information on this latest inhaled version of insulin. So a lot of you in the pre-webcast had questions for me, so I looked through all your questions. Thank you very much for putting those in there. And then you said, when is it going to be ready? Well, we've made the first step. It's FDA approved. It's going to take time now to partner with a company to produce it, to market it, and distribute. So how long is that going to take? It's not really known. Maybe a year? Just a vague estimate. It depends on who's ready to take this technology and bring it to the public. What's the pricing going to be? Well, I found one article that said similar to insulin pens, about $300 a month. But again, that's just an estimate. We don't know what actually is going to happen. And then what is Afrezza? Here, this is it. This is called Technosphere Technology. It has a huge surface area. It's very tiny. It's easily absorbed into the alveoli. And actually, what triggers its activation is the pH of the lung surface. The pH triggers the activation of this technosphere to release its insulin crystals and so forth. So it's a really amazing, amazing technology. But as you can imagine, if you're inhaling something into your lungs, one of the other side effects is cough. So people do have cough associated with this. If you look in the journals and the papers that talk about this insulin, they often refer to it as T1, which stands for technosphere insulin, just to let you know. So this is a bolus regular insulin inhaled before meals. And I asked you, what's the dosing? And it's actually 4 and 8 unit cartridges. So remember that gentleman who weighs 100 kilograms and he needs about 8 units of insulin per meal? This looks like it would be a great match for him, because he could take an 8-unit cartridge before every meal. So it's a conversion, which is so nice. The original inhaled insulin called Exubera was not a one-to-one conversion. This is. So this, we know how much insulin we're delivering in units of insulin terms, which is a big advantage. But the thing we do need to consider is, before starting inhaled insulin, is lung function tests. So we do incentive spirometer, and we in particular look at FEV1, which stands for forced expiratory volume. And that's going to be our gold standard. Does the patient have an adequate FEV to start this medication? And so the guy that in the case study, he was a smoker. So he smoked for many, many years. So we're going to have to evaluate very carefully his lung function. So this medication is not indicated for patients with chronic lung issues, asthma, COPD, history of lung cancer, and I'll tell you why. And those patients who took it, they had severe bronchospasm. So, this is a black box warning. We don't mess around with this. So any patient at high risk of bronchospasm, asthma, COPD, history of lung cancer, current lung cancer, really going to avoid it. Smokers, they did not test this medication on smokers, so we don't know what would happen, but they just avoided that. So maybe they'll have future studies on that. As I've mentioned, the side effects, hypoglycemia was less common than injected, sore throat, and cough. An important thing is, a lot of the patients really appreciate it not injecting. So their satisfaction with this inhaled insulin was greater than the injectable insulin. And I remember that being true also for patients on the old Exubera. They really appreciated not having to take an injection. So looking at quality of life, I think Afrezza really has the potential to offer improved quality of life. Many of you asked me, does this affect lung function? And the truth is, lung function does diminish over the first 3 months when on Afrezza. And this was true for the Exubera too, that they saw lung function over the 3 months diminishes slightly. And it's not enough diminishment where the patient's short of breath or they notice anything different. It's a slight diminishment. But it seems to stabilize. So 3 months, it drops a little bit, then it just stabilizes. But interestingly enough, in a slide I'll show you next, people with diabetes not on inhaled have diminishing lung function also. So it seems that diabetes might impact lung function regardless of inhaled insulin a little bit. I just want to raise that point. So we measure how the lung function is by FEV1, and then we have to measure it before they start, at baseline, at 6 months, and then yearly. And if it drops more than 20%, we're going to consider stopping a freeze. If they're complaining of any shortness of breath or, you know, excessive coughing, stop it. It wasn't tested on smokers, but interestingly, they did test it on some patients who were on albuterol, and when they took albuterol plus this, it actually enhanced the how quickly it was used in the lungs. It was used more rapidly. So here's what I was talking about, looking at lung function, patients on Afrezza compared to patients on oral meds. Both of these groups have diabetes. And you can look at the baseline FEV. This is a comparator, patients with diabetes on oral medications. You can see their lung function diminished over time. And this is a big group. They started with 1,000, 1,500 people. And as you know, with any study, people drop off over time. But it still indicates diminishing lung function, and here is the Afrezza. So they have a little bit increased diminishment of lung function, but again, not enough to make people stop taking it, but just something to really keep an eye on. So know your Afrezza inhaler. I just actually went to the website of MannKind, and I downloaded their patient education handout, and from their handout I created these slides. And so the handout is really excellent, and you can download that and share it with your patients. But these are just some things I thought would be very interesting to you. The size of the inhaler is amazingly small, which is really exciting. This purple cap covers the mouthpiece. This is the top, and the bottom of the inhaler has this purple color. So you remove the mouthpiece cover, and then here's the white mouthpiece. Now, this cartridge is the insulin right here, and they call this little thing underneath the cup. So this is the cup that's holding the insulin. You put the cup facing down into the base when you're actually using it. Now, I do want to say something. How do you know the insulin has been used? Well, after you use the insulin, this cup will move to the center. So unused insulin, the cup is at the edge. Once you use it, the cup moves to the center. And the thing about the inhaler is you have to replace it every 15 days, but make sure your patients don't actually wash it. Very important not to wash the inhaler. So some patients, you know, very clean, they like to sanitize things. Don't, because you don't want to get any water in that inhaler. Now, here's how it's stored and some terms that we need to be familiar with. There's 30 cartridges in this foil package. So there's two blister cards in this foil package. Each blister card has 15 strips. It says 5 strips. Let's all use their wording. So it has 5 strips with 3 cartridges per strip. So it has 15 cartridges in each of these blister cards. So a total of 30 cartridges. And once you open this foil pack, it's only good for 10 days. So what they're suggesting here is that every day you use 3 of these. So you use 3 a day for 10 days, that's 30. So once you open that foil package, it's good for 10 days. But once you open this strip, once you tear off the strip, it's only good for 3 days. So you'd have to use each of these, you know, within 3 days. So that's how it works. Refrigerated, not in use and sealed, good till expires. Once you take it, the foil package at room temperature, good for 10 days. Once you rip off a strip, it's good for 3 days. So our patients definitely need to know that. And then there's two strengths for Afrezza. We have the 4-unit cartridges that are in blue, and the green cartridges, about 8 units. Another very important teaching point as this is released, we need to let the insulin cartridges and inhaler sit at room temperature for 10 minutes before using. So a cold inhaled insulin, the Technosphere technology, it might affect the ability of that insulin powdered if it's cold when it inhaled. So we want to make sure it sits at 10 minutes at room temperature before using. And then here's the instructions on how to use it. You want to keep that inhaler level. And then you open the inhaler, here it is, by lifting the white mouthpiece. The cover's still on here. You lift the white mouthpiece, and then you hold the insulin cartridge with cup facing down. You place the cartridge inside and close it, and make sure to keep it level. This is very important. If you actually tip this inhale device, the powdered insulin might slip out. You might lose some of it. So you definitely want to make sure and keep it level and make sure cartridge has been at room temp for 10 minutes. So after you have it in there, you close it. And now what you're going to do is, this is how you inhale the insulin. First of all, you exhale. So you're going to blow out your air, and look how they're keeping the inhaler level. And then you make sure to take off the cover, so that little purple cover, and then put the device in your mouth. Now you keep your head straight, but you tilt the inhaler down toward chin, so like at a 30, 40 degree angle, to maximize the inhalation of this inhaled insulin, this powdered insulin. So you tilt the inhaler down toward chin, keep head level, inhale deeply and hold breath for as long as comfortable. And then breathe normally. And then you pull out the inhaled device out of your mouth and you remove the cartridge. You throw that away and you replace the mouth cover. That's it. That's pretty easy. So now we have to figure out how to get to the right dose. As I mentioned, there's a one-to-one relationship. So if I'm on 4 units of injected insulin, I would need 4 units of Afrezza. But what if I'm on 2 units or 3 units? I'd have to go up to 4. That's the minimum dose. There's no 1 unit Afrezza, unfortunately. If I'm on 5 to 8 units, I need 8 units or 1 green one. What if I'm 9 to 12? Well, I'm going to have to combine 2 inhaled cartridges. The blue and the green, the 4 and the 8 units, and so forth. So we're going to have to work with our patients to get the right dose of Afrezza to match their needs. So what I thought we'd do together is let's look at some patients. My patient here is 7 units of Humalog at meals and 20 units of Lantus at bedtime. So we know Afrezza is just a bolus insulin, so the patient still needs to stay on their basal insulin. But if they're on 7 units of Humalog at meals, what dose would we recommend they take of Afrezza? I'll go back. So it would be the 8 units or 1 green cartridge. I wanted to say something though. What if I have a type 1 who's very insulin sensitive? Maybe, 8 units might be too much for them. That might cause their blood sugar to go too low. So we need to know our patients. But a type 2, they're a little bit more insulin resistant, so they can tolerate an extra unit without me worrying about them crashing. So that might be acceptable. We need to know our patients, and we also need to look at their before meal blood sugar. What if their before meal blood sugar is 67? Well, we may be not that comfortable giving them 8 units of inhaled at meals, especially if they're type 1. And so all these decisions are going to be made by the patient and by the health the educator, the coach, the providers, together. It has to be a team because there's going to be some problem solving around this. If my before meal blood sugar is 170, I have no problem taking 8 units of inhaled insulin. I'm not worried about it at all. So you can see there's not a black and white here. There's going to have to be a lot of judgment by the patient and coaching by the healthcare professionals. Let's just take a look at this guy. His carb counts, he's 1 for 15. He had 75 grams of carb per meal for that meal. So he would need 5 units of insulin to cover that carb. And so Afrezza comes in 4 and 8. What is he going to do? Well, if he's a type 1, I might say let's just go for the 4, especially if his blood sugar is 67. If he's type 2, I feel a lot more comfortable saying, well, maybe we can go for the 8 unit. It's probably okay. And it's based on the patient history. Maybe it's a very lean type 2. I might be more reluctant to do that. And so just like with injected insulin, there's a lot of coaching, on-the-spot coaching, helping patients figure out the best solution for them. But with the inhaled insulin, you can see since it's only dosed in 4 and 8 units, it might be a little challenging at first for patients. So I just want to kind of share that with you and kind of get us thinking about that. Let's go back to my patient here, and this is actually a true story. This is not his picture, but this patient did come into me and with this whole situation, and he's on this Lantus, and he goes, Bev, I can't afford this Lantus. I can't afford an insulin pen. Is there any other choices for me? I have a big deductible. I'm cash pay. I'm reaching my max. Can you figure out any other insulin therapy that I can use? And so we know, obviously, well, Afrezza is not even approved yet, but it's not affordable at this point. unless the insurance covers it in the future. But right now, that the newer medications are always more expensive. And actually, I wrote a whole article on this topic because I have so many patients, I would call them working poor. They don't have good insurance. They have to cash pay for insulin, and they can't. They're telling me they can't afford it. And so I said, well, let me do some research and write a paper on this. And I did. So you can access it yourself. Just click on the link, or it's on the resources page I shared with you. And what I found out was something very amazing is that Walmart, the Relyon version of Walmart, and this is Novalin insulin. So it's a Novalin. Walmart just bought a huge amount of Novalin insulin, Novalin regular, Novalin MPH, Novalin 7030, and it provides it at a great cost of $25. This is Walmart's across the countries through the Relyon. So that patient who I was just telling you about, who was on 100 units of Lantus, we did a calculation and said, you weigh 100 kilograms, you need about 50 units total. And so we put him on 30 units of Lantus at night, and we started him on regular, 10 units a meal. So he went from 100 units to 60 units, and his blood sugars now are 130. This is what I mean by over-basalization. He went to Walmart, and he did not need a prescription to buy. You don't need a prescription for regular, MPH, or 7030. I told him, go to Walmart, get regular insulin. I'm going to call your provider and see if we can get you started on that. It was that easy. So I just want to reach out to all of you and say we have options that we can share with patients to help make this diabetes affordable. And when he's done with his Lantus, he's going to buy MPH and take MPH instead. He is so happy, I can't tell you. His provider's happy. I'm thrilled that he's got his blood glucose to target. You can see these other insulins are very expensive. And so we want to think about affordability for our patients as we work with them. And again, we want to think about, are they on the right insulin therapy based on their blood sugars, their body weight, and all of that? And I think this is a very excellent algorithm for helping us figure out where patients need to go. And what you can go to on my website, I've posted these algorithms, and I've also posted the complete article where you can download and look at management of insulin therapy in great, great detail. It's really, really helpful. And if you're interested in learning more about insulin therapy, pattern management, I encourage you to join us live. We're having two courses, one in Oakland in August and in San Diego in September. I would love for you to come join us. We have a great time at these programs. We talk about insulin pattern management. We talk about oral medications. And it's also a great course to help people who are ready to take their exam to become certified diabetes educators. So what I'd like to do now for the second half is talk about oral medications. So we've talked about insulin, we kind of went fast forward, but now let's talk about a management for glucose using oral medications or non-insulin therapies. Let me just see. So let's just launch one more question. If your patients are cash pay, which are some of the meds of choice that you would use in recommending medications for management of their type 2 diabetes? So we talked about the cost of insulin, but the cost of oral medications is also pretty phenomenal. So which of the medications out there can we recommend to patients if they're cash pay or have a big deductible that they could actually afford? Thank you so much for voting, everybody. I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this real quick and share with all of you. You guys are on fire because you totally got it right. Glipizide, sulfonylurea, very inexpensive. And I have a slide coming up on this, but glipizide from Walmart. Actually, all the sulfonylurea is at Walmart. You can get a three-month supply for $10. Three-month supply for $10. Metformin, also at Walmart, the Relyon, three-month supply for $10. Metformin oftentimes is cheaper cash pay for patients than using their insurance. It's usually, a few bucks a month. And MPH, you guys did great. Januvia and Lantus, the newer medications, are expensive. And so as we're working and figuring out which medications work for which patients, we certainly want to keep insurance coverage and costs in mind. So let me take a closer look now at the glycemic control algorithm put forth by AACE, and I think it's actually a really good algorithm. Again, it starts with lifestyle modification. And then it says if the A1C is less than 7.5, we could start with these medications in green. And you can see metformin is a top ranking medication. So the metformin, because we know it has so little side effects as far as causing problems, the main side effect that people have is GI in nature. And then they go down the list, the GLP-1, the glucagon-like peptides, the Byetta, Bydureon, Victoza. Then they go on to the DPP-4s, the Januvias, Onglyza, and Tradjenta, and Nesina. And then the AGIs, the alpha-glucosidase inhibitor, Acarbose. These in yellow proceed with caution. There's some issues. They're kind of new. And so the SGLT2 inhibitor, which we'll talk about in a minute, at the time they made this was still in clinical trials. It hadn't been FDA approved, but now it's FDA approved. I think it would probably get a green light because it has so many benefits, which we'll talk about. We start with monotherapy, and if the A1C is still above target, we're going to move on to metformin plus a secondary. And then if that is not, we're still not at goal in 3 months, we go to triple therapy and consider adding some insulin. So what I'd like to do now for the rest of the program is just spend some time talking about these different medications that we have available as far as oral medications and looking at some of the benefits and drawbacks. And this is a pretty quick review. So if you're familiar with this, this will be great. If you would like some more information on these medications, I do have a whole recorded webinar on diabetes medications, which goes over each of these medications in great detail that you can listen to. That's on our university website. These pocket cards, I hope you've had a chance to download them. They're a great reference. I originally put them together for myself because I'm like, how do I keep up with all these medications? And I go, hey, my friends probably could benefit from these. So we just started printing them out, and we'll ship them out to you for free, or you could download them from our website. But let's just talk about the different medications, and I'll just quickly highlight some of the benefits and some of the cautions. The biguanide is known as metformin. Now, metformin has been around a long time, so it's really inexpensive. But the fact that it's been around so long is terrific because we know a lot about it. It has a really good safety profile. Most patients tolerate it and get blood sugars really effectively under control because this medication lowers A1C 1 to 2 percentage points, which translates into a 30 to 60% blood glucose drop. I want to say something very important. A lot of my patients come in to see me. They're on the regular metformin, just the regular metformin glucophage. They're having GI upset, diarrhea. It's hurting their stomach. Get them off of that. Get them off the glucophage and get them on extended release. I have moved so many patients to extended release. Glucophage XR, it's generic. It's just as cheap. You take it once a day, and guess what? They could tolerate it, and their blood sugars come down. It's wonderful. So all my providers know, get them on Glucophage XR. I don't know why it's not used more. It's so amazing because patients have a lot less upset stomach with it and diarrhea. And it is a larger pill. It's harder to swallow, and that's one of the drawbacks. But other than that, it's terrific. So you know that with metformin, we need to take caution and look at their creatinine. This drug won't cause renal problems, but if you have poor kidney function, it may not be eliminated effectively, and the metabolites can build up in your bloodstream and lead to lactic acidosis. So we need to make sure they have good working kidneys for this medication. It's weight neutral, so patients might lose weight on it sometimes or stay the same, but they will not gain weight, and it doesn't cause hypoglycemia, which is awesome. Okay, so I talked about medications that are effective and cheap. We have another group called sulfonylureas. They work great. Look at that. They lower A1C 1 to 2 percentage points. Very inexpensive, but we do have major side effects, hypoglycemia and weight gain. And the average weight gain on sulfonylureas is anywhere from 2 to 4 pounds. So if I'm already overweight and I get on this medication and I see the scale going the wrong way, I'm not happy. And so sulfonylureas, even though they're very cheap and wildly effective, have these major drawbacks. So we're always considering that as we figure out what's the best for our patients. I'm going to move on to the DPP-4 inhibitors. So these are what we call incretin enhancers. What does that mean? Well, they help our own gut hormones work better because they stop this enzyme, DPP-4, from breaking down our own gut hormone. So look at all of them that we have available, Januvia, Onglyza, Tradjenta, Nucina. And it's once-a-day dosing, and you could see there's different elimination routes. But the thing about these medications is they really cause very few side effects. Some patients might complain of upper respiratory tract, like coughing, sneezing, they feel congested. Some might get a headache. That's about it. But other than that, it's very non-problematic in the side effect category. But look at this. You don't get a big bang for your buck. It's going to lower the A1C by about a half to 1 percentage point. So this is a great medication for patients who just have A1C slightly elevated, who don't need a lot more. Maybe their A1C is 7.5. You just want to get it down below 7. A great choice if the insurance covers it. I've had patients call me back and say, "This medication cost me $300 for a 3-month supply. I can't afford it." So you want to make sure that their insurance covers that. So no weight gain or hypoglycemia. Let me spend a little bit of time on our SGLT2 inhibitors. So what does that mean in English? Well, I read an article where the writer called it a glucuretic. So these medications help you diurese glucose. So they tell your kidneys, release the glucose. You don't need to hold on to it. So remember how I said the renal threshold for glucose with diabetes is 210? It kind of resets it to 180. So they release the glucose, and along with the glucose goes water. So you can imagine if it's a glucuretic, it lowers the blood sugar, but also it can help with blood pressure and blood sugar because you're losing volume. The other thing is that as you're losing that water and sugar, you might be losing electrolytes. So we're definitely going to monitor your potassium, renal function, and electrolytes, and we're going to keep a close eye on that blood pressure. The thing about these medications is I want to say that they do affect GFR. On both of these medications, you'll see the glomerular filtration rate kind of take a little drop when you start. And then it stabilizes over time, and when you stop the medication, it goes back up. But if the GFR is less than 60, we're going to stop the Farxiga. And if GFR is less than 45, we stop the Invokana. So I'm always looking at GFR for patients on these medications because it can really cause, like if you imagine if your kidneys, if you're already dry, this is going to dry things out even more, and maybe there won't be enough volume to the kidneys. Any medication that increases the release of glucose through the urine increases the risk of genital infections because there's all the extra sugar and urine together can increase that risk. So I just let patients know. And Farxiga, there is a warning to avoid in patients with bladder cancer. Now, this medication will not cause low blood sugar, and patients lower weight on it. They lose weight, 1 to 3 pounds. So here we have the blood sugars coming down and the body weight coming down. Our patients are happy. They love that. But they are going to the bathroom a lot more. So just to let them know that. And look at this, it can lower the A1C up to 1.5%. So that means a blood sugar drop of potentially 45 points. The patient on that case study was on Invokana, and his insurance covered that. He could afford it. So we decided to keep trying it and keep him on the metformin, Invokana, MPH, and regular insulin, four different types of medications to get blood sugar to target. The TZD, thiazolidinediones, Actos, and Avandia. Actos actually may increase the risk of bladder cancer, and TZDs actually. The Avandia was released. It actually now it doesn't have any more black box warnings saying increased risk of heart attack. So Avandia and Actos are choices that we can use, but Actos has the bladder cancer issue, but they both can cause or worsen CHF, and we need to monitor for edema and weight gain. So any patient on these medications, when they walk in, I'm looking at their ankles. I want to see how swollen are their ankles, are they gaining fluid weight, and if they are, this may not be a good medication choice for them. These are now generic, but they're still about $100 a month in many situations. They lower A1C about 0.5 to 1%. I'm not going to spend too much time on these other medications because they're not used very frequently. Dopamine receptor agonist called Cyclocet was approved, was purchased by a company, but it really hasn't taken off as far as it being used that much. Acarbose, which is a glucosidase inhibitor, has been around for a while. It actually did a really good job in people with prediabetes. This was in the ACE guidelines. They gave patients acarbose. It really helped to lower blood sugars and move them out of prediabetes. But one of the main problems is the gas production. So the flatulence is a real barrier to people staying on this medication. And then we have the meglitinides that are rarely used. So I just want to spend a little more time on the SGLT2 inhibitors, since those are some of our newer medications that we have available. And as I've mentioned, they're a glucuretic, which decrease renal absorption in the proximal tubules. And we have two medications in this category, the Invokana, and you see the dosing here is 1 to 300 milligrams daily with the first meal. And looking at the GFR, we need to be cautious. If it's too low, we're going to either not exceed 100 milligrams a day, or if it's less than 45, don't use. And then we have the Farxiga, which we don't use if patient has bladder cancer or history and report any blood in the urine. And you can see these really do not only lower blood sugar, but can also help with weight reduction. So really nice resource for our patients who are struggling to lose that weight. And as I've mentioned, we're going to monitor the blood pressure, potassium, and kidney function. The thing about this type of medication, it does seem to improve beta cell function. And so we're looking at that a lot more now. Do these medications, if started early on, have any beta cell protective effects? Because we want these beta cells to last as long as possible in our patients with diabetes and be able to produce insulin as long as possible. And I think that's one of the exciting things also about the other kind of medications, the Byetta and the Bydureon and Victoza. They also seem to help protect beta cell and increase their function over time. So let's talk about those. We have injectables that lower the blood sugar. So not only do we have insulin as an injectable, we have now other medications that patients can inject to help get blood sugars to target. And they're called incretin mimetics. These medications stimulate glucose-dependent insulin release. What does that mean? Well, actually what it does is when you eat food and the blood sugars rise, it tells the pancreas to make insulin. So it's glucose-dependent insulin release. So that's just how our pancreas is supposed to work. When we get information that blood sugars are coming up from food, our pancreas releases insulin, and this helps the pancreas to function better. You can see these are for type 2s only, and they lower A1C about 0.5 to 1.6%. But the great thing about these medications is that they also lower body weight. So patients taking these medications see weight loss 3-6 pounds would be a very kind of typical weight loss for these patients. So let's just go over these different ones that are available. And I do want to say for people with diabetes type 2, they may not have, they make about 50% of normal of the gut hormones. They make about 50% less GLP and GIP, so they don't get a feeling of satiation. So these medications, what they're doing is giving them the sense of fullness and telling their pancreas to make more insulin so that they have less of an appetite, so it helps with weight loss and blood glucose lowering. The first one that was approved was exenatide or Byetta, and Byetta was a twice-a-day injection, 5 to 10 micrograms, renally excreted. So patients would take this before breakfast and dinner. But then what happened is that about a year and a half ago, they released a version of Exenatide XR, extended release. This is so exciting. So many of my patients who are on twice a day Exenatide went over to this once a week injection called Bydureon. And they're getting just as good glucose control. They're still seeing the weight loss, and they're really enjoying the respite from having to take two injections a day. The one thing that patients do complain of is a bump at the site of injection. So it doesn't usually hurt. It's just an inflammation or a bump from the injection of the powdery. It's a liquid, so it's a powder that you reconstitute in liquid, but it takes time to get absorbed. So it kind of sits underneath the skin for a while as it's absorbed over time. Okay, so, and then there's a Victoza. Victoza is a once-a-day injection, and so that's still being used. But as the once-a-week came out, more patients are moving to the once-a-week injection just for ease of use. For all of these here, we do have a pancreatitis warning. So we know that people with diabetes are more likely to get pancreatitis in general. We're not sure if these medications are increasing the risk, but what I've seen is several papers have come out recently saying these medications, the incretin mimetics, do not increase risk of pancreatitis. So that's the latest data that's been flowing through, so you can kind of reassure patients. But for the liraglutide and Exenatide XR, there is a thyroid C-cell tumor warning. So any patient who has a history, a thyroid tumor, should not really use this medication. We also have an amylin mimetic, and this is known as Simlin or pramlintide. And this is an injection usually given to patients with type 1 or type 2 on insulin. So you would take the injection of pramlintide before meals plus insulin. And so it's not used very frequently because it required, you know, patients to take 7 injections a day. But they are working on a formulation where they would mix the insulin and the pramlintide in one solution so that patients could take one injection and get the benefits of both medications. So hopefully we'll see that come out in the next few years. As a matter of fact, on your resource page, I put a paper that talked about, it's just released 2014, new medications that are on the horizon. So you can go ahead and take a look at that article and see what are they working on for the future, because there's so many exciting things that they're trying to work toward. And so kind of getting back to this, you can see that for patients with the A1C less than 7.5, we might start them on, you know, metformin or these other medications to keep their blood sugar and get them to target of less than 7 ADA, less than 6.5 AACE. But if their A1C is climbing, we might have to add a secondary agent or a third agent or actually go to insulin therapy. This is the ADA guidelines. So they have it presented in a little different way. And they say start patients healthy eating, weight control, increase physical activity, add metformin, and then if that doesn't get patients to target, we need to add these other medications. And I think it's worth noting that they actually look at these medications from a different perspective that I think is very helpful for us. And they look at them from efficacy. So they say, let's look at these secondary medications. Are they efficacious? Sulfonylureas are. So are the TZDs, the DPP-4s, the Januvia, et cetera, intermediate. The GLP-1 agonists, like the Byetta, Bydureon, Victoza, high efficacy. And insulin, basal insulin, has the highest. Insulin will always work to get blood sugar to target. What about hypoglycemia? You can see here that moderate risk with metformin plus sulfonylurea. The rest of them are low risk except for insulin. And then here's weight gain. We know sulfonylureas cause weight gain. If you have metformin plus sulfonylurea, they still gain weight because of the sulfonylurea. Thiazolidinediones also can cause weight gain. You know why? Fluid retention. These others are neutral or cause weight loss. But insulin does cause some weight gain for our patients. And I do want to say that anytime a patient starts on insulin therapy and their A1C is 13 and we're going to bring that A1C down to 9 or 7 or 8, they're going to gain some weight. And I really tell them that that weight gain is a sign of your body healing. The weight gain is a sign of your body recovering. It's telling you you have enough insulin on board. I want them to expect that weight gain so they don't freak out and they don't stop taking the insulin. And so if I set them up for success and frame it in a way that this is your body healing, it really does help them a lot. And the other thing I would say is, you know what, let's expect about 3 to 5 pound weight gain, but after that, we're going to work really hard to keep you right there. And I will do everything in my power to make sure you don't gain any additional weight. And you know how you avoid extra weight gain? I'll tell you, it's not giving them too much basal. If we over-basalize people, they're more likely to gain weight. Give them that nice blend of bolus and basal. That helps mitigate that weight gain. Major side effects. Sulfonylurea, we know this, hypo. The thiazolidinediones, edema, heart failure. Fractures. Yeah, it does have, you do get more ankle fractures and wrist fractures. Metformin, rare. Plus the DPP-4 inhibitor, rare side effects. The GLP-1 agonist, some GI side effects. They do get some nausea. And then, as you know, insulin causes that hypoglycemia. And then they rate the cost. Wow, this is terrific. So you can see the lowest cost is metformin. These other ones are high because they're newer. And then insulin is variable, like I've mentioned to you before. So let me just do one more poll. For someone not trying to gain weight, which of the medications would you choose to start them on? Someone trying not to gain weight. And you can choose more than one. All right, take a few more minutes. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this and share with you. Great job, everybody. Only 4% of you chose sulfonylureas. So patients who are put on sulfonylureas gain weight. So if a patient comes in and says to you, man, I'm really struggling with my weight and my blood sugars are high, I would really stay away from sulfonylureas if I could, if that was something I could do. Because sometimes I may need to start a sulfonylurea. If that patient is cash pay, they don't have that much of an income, I might have to choose a sulfonylurea and really help them through the food and activity to minimize weight gain. But you are right. Metformin does not cause weight gain. Byetta or the incretin mimetics do not cause weight gain. Actually, they cause weight loss. Invokana causes weight loss. It's a glucuretic. And the DPP-4, the Januvias, are what we call weight neutral. They don't cause weight loss or weight gain. So those would be okay too. So these right here will not cause weight gain. So they would be good choices for that person. The B, C, D, and E do not cause weight gain. I just wanted to share with you the profiles of anti-diabetic medications. This is from AACE, and you know, if you're new to medications, you want to learn more about them or just get some more insights, this is a great chart to just have at your disposal. And you can take a look at how these medications affect blood glucose and are increase or have decreased rate of hypoglycemia, how they affect weight, renal and GU considerations, stomach side effects, heart failure, heart disease, bone issues. So this is a real nice summary chart of considerations for these different medications. Other considerations include cost, hypoglycemia, age, weight, and other comorbidities. So for the last few slides, I'd like to take a look at these and just discuss this. We've already alluded to a lot of this, but I just want to wrap it up in a package so that it's easier to remember. When the goal is to minimize costs, go generic. And I've talked about this. Metformin and sulfonylureas are the cheapest. Walmart offers a 3-month supply of the following meds for about $10. Metformin and Metformin XR. This is a 3-month supply. Glipizide, glaburide, glimepiride. I did some research, and there are other generics available, Actos, Navan, DNA, Carbos, but they can still cost you up to $100 a month. So it's just really kind of needing to look at our patients, what their budget limitations are, and what they can afford, and what's the best therapy for them. And right here I have that article again, Medications on a Budget, How to Help Patients Afford These Medications. When your goal is to avoid hypoglycemia, so I have a lot of patients, I work with an elderly community, they live alone, and they're, I would call frail elderly, maybe they have cardiovascular disease. I'm very afraid of them getting low blood sugar, and so I'm going to choose medications that don't put them at risk for hypoglycemia, and in that situation, I'm going to avoid sulfonylureas, glipizide, glyburide, glimepiride, if I can at all costs, especially if they have kidney function issues. So any patient with elevated renal function, they're going to hold on to sulfonylureas a lot longer, and they're at risk for hypoglycemia. And so sulfonylureas are, you know, really even more dangerous if they have any degree of kidney function problem, a creatinine greater than 1.4. I'm going to proceed with caution. If they're on insulin, I'm not going to give Lantus or NPH at night. I'm going to give the basal insulins in the morning. I want them to have less risk of nocturnal hypoglycemia because nocturnal hypoglycemia can be life-threatening. They may not wake up. So I want to give their insulin toward the morning so when they're sleeping, they have more of a safety net. Very careful insulin dosing. And here I have may need to up adjust glucose goals. For patients who are frail elderly living by themselves, I'm worried about hypoglycemia, I might say to them, I don't want your blood sugar less than 100 when you wake up in the morning. So that is going to be an individualization of the goals to help keep people safe. And the other thing is we want to reinforce for patients on insulin to tie. And I go over this a lot in my class because I went over this with the patient many times. You need to test, inject, eat, tie. Test your blood sugar, inject the insulin, and eat. Many patients do the test and inject, and they forget to eat. And so I always say to them, insulin has to interact with food. For insulin to work, you need to eat carbohydrates with it. If you're going to take your insulin, you've got to eat. I word it in 20 different ways because many patients forget that aspect of injecting and eating. Critical point to get across to help prevent low blood sugar. When our goal is to avoid weight gain, medications that are weight neutral, these will cause no weight gain. Sometimes metformin can cause some weight loss, but on most people it's what we call weight neutral. So metformin, the DPP-4 inhibitors, and acarbose are weight neutral. You neither gain or lose weight on them. But if you want to help your patients lose weight, so I meet with a patient and she's like, Bev, I'm so tired, I'm overweight, I can't get my weight down. First thing I'm thinking in my head is maybe one of these meds will be a good match for her or him, especially these GLP-1 agonists, Byetta, Bydureon, Victoza. They really help to stimulate satiety and help lower blood sugars, and people see weight loss with them. Also, the SGLT2 inhibitors, the glucuretics, they're going to help people lose weight and get their blood sugars down. Simlin, it will promote weight loss, but most people can't tolerate it or it's not used very frequently. So these two and metformin are kind of my go-to meds for patients really struggling with weight. Of course, I'm always going to check for the GLP-1 agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors to make sure their insurance will cover it. Older adult considerations. So in the ACCORD trial, they worked with a lot of older patients in this trial, and they had heart disease and other vascular complications, and they were putting them on very intensive insulin regimens. And what they were noticing, what happened is that in some patients, they increased their risk of death. And so they said, you know, maybe for our older adults with heart disease and other complications, we need to rethink how we approach it. And it says for those patients, maybe we have a less ambitious target of 7.5 to 8% to keep them safe. And what additional benefit will they get by getting the A1C to 6%? They may not get any additional benefit as far as quality of life or increased life expectancy, and they might actually be at higher risk for hypoglycemia. You know, hypoglycemia can also stimulate atrial fibrillation. fibrillation. So it can cause AFib in our patients. And then if they have low blood sugar and AFib, that puts them in a very compromising situation. So we just want to really be thoughtful about what our targets are for our high-risk patients and really look at their GFR and their heart disease and their life expectancy. We want to focus on drug safety. And so another really important part of this team is a pharmacist. You know, the pharmacist is going to help make sure that these drugs work complementary. He or she can help us with the best pricing for our patients and also look at it from a safety perspective. So truly, diabetes is the interdisciplinary team working together. And at the center of the team is the person living with diabetes. They're going to help us make the best choices. With weight consideration, you know, most of our patients with type 2 are overweight or obese, about 90% of them. So we really want to focus on an intensive lifestyle program, helping them lose that 2 to 8 kilograms of body weight to protect their pancreas, to help their pancreas work better. We'll consider metformin or GLP-1 agonists and bariatric surgery. Now, this is from the ADA position statement. So they say maybe for our very morbidly obese patients, bariatric surgery is an option, and actually patients with bariatric surgery may actually have remission of their diabetes. So let me just explain what remission means. Remission means you still have diabetes, but the blood glucose is normalized. It means that you have diabetes, but you don't require medications to manage it. It doesn't mean it's gone. It doesn't mean it's cured. It doesn't mean it's never going to come back. Remission means at that moment, your blood sugars are normal without medication. And you can see with bariatric surgery, the success rate ranges from 40 to 95%. And the sooner we get the person into surgery with diabetes and the more beta cell mass they have, the better results they have. Interestingly enough, even before the weight loss, we'll notice post-bariatric surgery, the blood sugars come down. You know why? Because they have more gut hormones available. So that bariatric surgery raises their endogenous production of GLP and GIP, which helps lower the blood sugar, promote satiety. Interesting. So bariatric surgery is a consideration. So to sum up for today, these are some critical points, and I think these are very excellent points, and the American Diabetes Association put these forth in their paper. We want to individualize our glycemic targets and look at how low we want that blood sugar to go based on the person's life expectancy, their goals, their other comorbidities, and so forth. It's all about individualization, and if you're thinking about taking the CDE exam, that's what they're going to ask about. How do we individualize the plan and the treatment to match this patient? I love this. Diet, exercise, and education is a foundation for diabetes therapy. Only 10% of patients are referred to a dietitian for medical nutrition therapy. Only 20% ever go to a class in their lifetime. We need to make this a routine part. Diabetes means a referral to the dietitian, to the diabetes educator, to a support group, to resources in the community, to a pharmacist to evaluate their medication regimen. We need to do more to help patients access education, support, information, especially around diet and exercise. Metformin is optimal first-line drug. There's just no debating that. I would also consider, you know, exercise and diet an intervention, a therapeutic intervention. I always tell my patients that. I go, when you exercise, that's like injecting 4 units of insulin. You know, I'll just base it on that patient. But you'll see if they exercise after dinner, they can get those morning blood sugars down, and they might have a decrease in their insulin needs. As far as other oral medications, like, so you have metformin, you want to add other medications, we still need more data. But it seems that combination therapy is reasonable. And ultimately, many patients with type 2 will require insulin therapy. We know about 30% of patients with type 2 are on insulin, and probably a lot more would benefit from it. And so I'm hoping with this availability of inhaled insulin, more patients will start insulin therapy who really need it but have been pushing back against it because of the needles. Or maybe more providers will initiate the conversation about insulin if it's an inhalable version versus an injectable version. So I think this really offers us an opportunity to get patients' blood sugar to target earlier. I love this next bullet. All treatment decisions should be made in conjunction with the patient. Focus on preferences, needs, and values. What are their values? What do they believe in? How do they feel about medications? What is their budget? There's so many different things to consider. So the more we engage the patients and the treatment decisions, the more likely they are to keep up with them. A very important point, cardiovascular risk reduction is a major focus of therapy. Diabetes is a cardiovascular disease, and we need to really address risk reduction in addition to blood sugar, looking at blood pressure and cholesterol. I have so enjoyed spending this hour and a half with you. Thank you for joining us. If you would like to get some more information on medications and all kinds of other topics, the AADE has just released for pre-order the Diabetes Self-Management Education Reference. It's a 2014 version, and we have it available for pre-order. And if you're thinking about taking the exam, we have the Education Review Guide, which offers 200 questions in the book and 200 computer-based questions. So you get 400 practice questions. The other thing is, after this webinar ends, we're going to send you a survey. If you could just take a few minutes to answer it, I really appreciate it. If you have questions after this webcast, I'm going to stay for a few minutes and answer any questions, and you can always email me afterward. We invite you to visit our website at diabetesed.net. We just try and fill it with resources that are useful and helpful for you as you move forward in providing your excellent diabetes care to our patients living with diabetes every day. This is Beverly Tomasian. I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'll be signing off, but I'll be staying on to answer any additional questions. Thank you so much.